our series. It's the first in our series for 2010-2011 series, and I'm very happy that you've chosen to join us today. My name is Janet Peters. I'm a project coordinator for the Great Lakes ADA Center, and the Accessible Technology webinar series is sponsored by the Great Lakes ADA Center and the Pacific ADA Center, both members of the ADA National Network. We have just a couple of housekeeping items as we get started here. I first of all want to thank you for your patience. Technology is always an interesting thing. And there will be time at the end of the session for questions. You can type your questions in the chat area, as well as you can type in the chat area at any point during the presentation. And Paul and I will try to monitor and make sure that all questions are answered. We will be using the poll feature today of our tool. And if you are with us, the poll feature, you can either click on the green check mark or the red X mark for yes and no. If you're using a screen reader, control 1 is a yes answer and control 2 is a no answer. We will be captioning as soon as our captioner is available. And once that happens, we might take just a 1 minute break to get that set up. And the CC symbol will be on the lower right-hand area of your viewing area. If you click on that icon once we have the captioning, you'll be able to resize the window and move it on your screen as needed. We are recording today's session, and the archive will be available at the adaaudio.org site that you registered at. You will receive an email as soon as it's available with the link to the archive as soon as possible. You can always visit the ADA Audio website as well to look for the archive information. The handouts for today's session are also on that website that you registered at ada-audio.org. So without any further ado, let's get started. Today's session is How to Conduct a Workplace Computer Accessibility Assessment. I'm very pleased to have speaker with us, Paul Schwartz. Paul is a rehabilitation engineer at the Assistive Technology Manager for the Stout Vocational Rehabilitation Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Stout. He is originally from Pennsylvania and received a BS in Civil Engineering from Penn State University and an MS in Industrial and Systems Engineering from Ohio University. Paul's thesis involved researching the design interface for the Touch Talker, which is an augmentative communication device. He is a RESNA certified assistive technology professional, a certified rehabilitation engineering technologist, and a certified professional ergonomist. He provides job and home site accommodations, computer access, and ergonomic services to industry, state agencies, educational systems, insurance companies, and individuals. In addition, he has taught graduate level courses on ergonomics, assistive technology, and computer applications in rehabilitation. He has also trained assistive technology professionals nationwide. Mr. Schwartz has been a frequent presenter and faculty at Closing the Gap, CSUN, and RESNA, large assistive technology conferences. Mr. Schwartz is the past chair of RESNA's Special Interest Group in Job Accommodations and Employment Issues and served for 7 years on RESNA's Professional Standards Board. He is a current member of RESNA's Board of Directors, and he has worked for the University of Wisconsin-Stout for over 19 years, and prior to that he worked in product design for Semantic Compact Systems and Prankey Romig. We are very pleased to have him speaking with us today, and with that I will turn it on over to him.
Hi, thanks Janet. Geez, I didn't know that whole bio was going to be read. I apologize. It's like we don't have any time for the actual session. No, I'm teasing. Thanks. This is exciting for me as somebody who's in a technology to actually conduct a webinar. Of course, the bad part is that I don't get to see everyone's faces. So I hope that you will grab onto the technology, and because I think it is a nice way to do things without having to get out and about. I work at the University of Wisconsin-Stout, and next slide, and you can see that is in northwest Wisconsin, and it's about an hour from Minneapolis. And just to give you a sense of what the weather's like here. I have a recent photo of my office. Next slide. And of course, this is showing a major whiteout. Of course, I'm kidding. It's the not quite winter yet, but it's coming very soon, although we have a beautiful day here in Wisconsin. The next slide. Our Vocational Rehabilitation Institute does vocational evaluation, placement, assistive technology, benefits counseling, research, education, training, and because it's my section, I named it, I labeled it twice, assistive technology. But, you know, enough about me. I'm going to try this vote thing, and let's put up a poll with the red check and X and the green check. How many people work in a school district? Let's have a look at that. All right, so let's pop this up. So most of you do not. Okay, now I'm going to try clearing this thing. Okay, now how many people work with the adult population with vocational rehabilitation? Okay, let's see how we got there. Okay, a fair amount. And let's see, how about, I got to clear this thing. Okay, let's try another one. How about folks that work for private industry looking for internal accommodations? Okay, 20, good, great. Let's try this now. I'm going to clear this one. And if I missed anybody or if anybody wants to chime in, let's pop that in on the little chat box there so we can see where we're missing. Who are we missing? Oh, veterans. Okay, great. Yep. All right. Government agency, one-stop centers, government. Oh, sure enough. And, of course, I'm a mixed bag because I'm a state employee at the University of Wisconsin, but academic. Contractor, government. Okay, great. All right. Well, thanks for that. I appreciate that. Independent consultants. Oops, I'm sorry. So the course objectives, next slide, we want to develop one methodology in computer access assessments. And this is my methodology. You know, I've developed it over the years. Many folks I talk, our colleagues across the country, follow a fairly similar model that I hope I can help you with your work out there. And of course, we'll talk about some case. Oops, one hand raised. All right. Okay. Hand is raised. Now. Okay, who's raising their hand? Do you have a question? Okay, all right, I'll keep going on. Through case studies and OPACs, no problem. At least we know it's working. General access equipment and then some resources. Okay, next slide. Yeah, a lot of what we do in assistive technologies is very much borrowed from the human factors world, where we're looking at this person-machine system. So if we take the example of somebody using a computer, of course we have the displays, which the standard methodology for displays would be, of course, the screen. Now, of course, who can type in another alternative way to get a display? Anybody have any ideas out there? Braille, that's right, a Braille display, professional Braille speech, pouring in, yeah, excellent. So however, folks, audio, yeah. So however that is displayed, of course, then that has to be picked up by the person. So we cross this divide of the person-machine interface, and then the person perceives it, makes a decision, and then comes up with some sort of motor response to operate the computer. Okay, yeah, JAWS, that's right, audio. So then, of course, there's a number of ways for a motor response that we'll get into, and then that goes back into the controls of the computer crossing this man-machine, a person-machine interface, and this process just goes around in a circular route for a general model. Okay, next slide. The accommodation model is that we look at the worker's ability and we look at the job demands. And then, of course, I'm a rehab engineer, I'm not a doctor, so I don't do medical intervention, but that can be part of it, along with assistive technologies and then ergonomics. And then see if there's a compatibility there, and if not, well, then they keep passing wrap around the horn for assessing the worker's abilities and job demands until we finally get a successful job placement or someone able to maintain their position. Regardless of the model used, next slide, the assessment involves the individual, the environment, and their interaction. One of the Bibles, next slide, one of the Bibles of the assistive technology world is Assistive Technology by Cook and Hussey. The original one came out in 1995. And the goal of any access assessment is to evaluate the match between the device characteristics and the consumer skills and needs. Real simple model where we're just looking at, next slide, I'm sorry, personal abilities and the goals requirements, and then you find the mismatch. All right, where are the inconsistencies? What can the person do? What can the person not do? And then with that, you develop objectives for the goal, develop specifications for the accommodations, and then you come up with a range of possible solutions, and then identify preferred solutions. Okay, next slides. So the general process, and this is really based on most of my work comes from either the state voc rehab agencies around this area, some from the VA, some from schools, some from private industry. But this is how I conduct my work. Obviously, if you're doing internal accommodations, it might be slightly modified. But with the referral, tracking down the background information, developing a plan, interviewing, assessing the individual, skills evaluation, wrapping up, and then a report, and of course some follow-up. The next slide. So clearly define objectives when we're taking a referral. This is important. Many times assistive technology deals with a lot of different avenues. For example, when I do job accommodations, I might be working with someone that might need a whole range of assistive technologies, but many times the referring agency doesn't really care if they can operate the TV because that doesn't have to do with their vocational goals. So we want to define from whoever's calling us as an assessor the objectives, and then getting any information if there's been previous assessments, any type of other data that you can get that we could use for that, and the funding, where it's going to take place, and then the timelines to, so people aren't left hanging. The prognosis, diagnosis, I'm sorry, next slide, is it progressive in nature? Will this be getting worse over time? Because we want to factor that in terms of our technology. What about the community family context? The educational background and abilities. All this information is helpful in determining what technology is appropriate for the person. Next slide. There are specific concerns when you're talking with the consumer. What are they concerned about? Previous experience with computers, previous experience with assistive technology, was it a good or bad experience? Sometimes people are set up with stuff that was really inappropriate. And then they just kind of reject the whole, all the technology. And if there's been a functional capacity assessment or any type of other type of physical abilities test or cognitive testing. Next slide. Of course, you need to use the proper equipment. I have a picture of a guy with, I am in Wisconsin, of course, so I have to have the cheese head in there. Any other cheese heads out there? I know Karen's out there. What other? Anybody else from Wisconsin on the line here? in exile. That's because of the picture with the snow slide, I'm guessing, John. But anyway, all right. Well, next slide. We want to assess. I mean, as I said, I'm not a physician, but woohoo, cheesehead. Oh, there we go. Assess the vision and visual perception. Are people picking things up visually? I mean, you know, just kind of general. Are they seeing the screen? A bunch of Madison grads too. There we go. Cognition, physical abilities, limitations. Assessing the reaction to various technologies. Some people are way into it. Other ones, they're very concerned about their appearance. Does it hit the cool factor? Some are more bothered than that than others. And do they seem reticent to try new technology? And, of course, I use a tape measure, stopwatch or a watch, goniometer if I have to measure angles. Go Badgers, there you go. Although I am a Nittany Lion, I got to say. All right, next slide. And looking at this frustration, tolerance, motivation, you know, it varies from soup to nuts of how much people are in it, how motivated they are to make things happen. And if we can use quantifiable results, we want to do that. Error rate, words per minute, anything like that in terms of marking things. If you want to get real specific, there's a software program called Compass, which is a computer access program that can actually quantify targeting, dragging, clicking skills on the mouse, and then your actual keyboarding skills as well. Has anybody used Compass? Let's do a vote on that. Anybody has used Compass software? Okay. Yeah, some have. Great. Great. Yeah, it's a Compass is spelled COMPASS. Oh, Jamie got it. Thank you, Jamie. Let's clear this thing. Okay. And also, we want to record what didn't work, what worked and didn't work, because that you're leaving a paper trail of for maybe another professional down the line that might work with his consumer. So then they said, geez, they already tried the trackball and it didn't work for whatever reason. But if you just list the thing that you attended, future generations don't know what not to try or you know why it didn't work. The next slide. And then with the wrap up, the okay, difficult to get the data in a relatively short trial. Oh, it's interesting. You should probably give you can. This is Leo is asking about the getting the data. You can always contact the company too. They're a very small outfit, and if it was an issue, they'd probably work on it. Actually, so when we're doing an assessment wrap up, we want to look at these recommendations. If there's any type of paperwork, of course, we're CAR certified, so we have accredited. So we have a lot of paperwork with that to make sure we're doing the right thing. Who's doing what, funding services, sources, and when things are going to happen, and any questions. I think the biggest thing that we run into is the funding. When we work with folks and make recommendations, many times, of course, it goes back to the referring agency, and they have to make the call. And people might get upset if I make recommendations for some sort of assistive technology, and then they're upset because they're not getting it like the next day. And it's like, and I always tell them, you know, I don't hold the purse strings. The referring agency actually has a checkbook on purchasing these. Has that ever happened to anybody else in your practice? Let's have a vote on that. Of this delay of making things happen for a consumer. You know, a lot of folks it's popping up. I think, and surprise, surprise, it's I think it's just funny is always an issue. It's that's the nature of the beast in this field. Okay, great. Let's go to the next slide. And then the reporting, individual skills, recommendations, cost vendors, different solutions for different environments. Maybe somebody can use one system at home and another type of work at work. And the peripheral equipment, do they have a printer? Can they get to a printer? Does it fit? Does the assistive technology fit in the environment, family, and school system? Is it portable? I mean, one of the things we run into with some assistive technologies is that the setup time can be unwieldy. And then you have to factor in, okay, is anybody there to actually set things up? Or do you have to come up with a plan that will take a little bit less intervention on each setup time? Next slide. Of course, we're developing it. We'd want to develop a range of options. Sometimes that's for funding. Sometimes it's there's a choice involved where consumers can kind of think about it. Sometimes people might prefer to drop down a little bit in efficiency because it's a cooler look, which is certainly fine. If it still works for them, but they don't want to stand out, then they might opt for a different type of keyboard, for example. And then, of course, for funding, often we want to detail the need for the technology in terms of the injury or disability. I'm a big fan of backup systems. If, for example, speech recognition doesn't work, what else is this person for that day? What else is this person going to do? And then the details of purchase, setup, training, and who does everything. Okay, next slide. Then the follow-up implementation of a plan. Your work, you get to actually install things, looking at the access technique, phone calls, ongoing training. This is often an iterative approach. When you're working with somebody, you're not working with them over a month. I mean, it might be a couple hours or at tops probably a couple days, and you may not always hit the mark the first time. So being prepared that you might have to take a couple passes at it is certainly possible. The next slide. So when we're assessing the computer skills, we want to go much broader than the mouse. We want to look at the environment. How about the lighting? How about the seating? Any good computer access assessment should be begin with seating. Next slide. I am a big believer in the KISS rule. Start with simple solutions and move to complicated ones. Stay on top of the products in the field so you know what's out there right now. And then keep a critical eye on these things. I try not to fall in love with any product for over time. I'm not a vendor. I'm here to assess people. So if something trumps something else, I don't want to just be married to something just because I've used it for years. If something's better, then be prepared to do that, because ultimately we're trying to get the best accessibility accommodations for a consumer. And also develop a range of possible solutions. The expression, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And sometimes you see that with folks that are just starting out, or if maybe they're in a small school district and they went to a hour presentation on a particular product. Well, then, I've seen this where AT specialists have tried to kind of shoehorn folks into a particular product because that's what they know and they love. So you want to try to avoid that. Next slide. We want to be concerned with function, but don't ignore aesthetics. If it looks too radical, people reject the technology. I think one of the things that has really helped is the advent of the ergonomic keyboard. I remember when the Microsoft Natural keyboard came out, I believe in 1995, and it was so cutting edge, it was in Popular Science magazine. And we ran out and bought that thing, and it's been great. I use a Wave keyboard now. But what it did was it kind of broke the mold of what a keyboard should look like. And that's helpful now because it's not too much of a stretch to go to the, all these other different types of alternative keyboards for people with injuries or disabilities. So that helps change the paradigm of what this technology could look for, and it's accepted more in the mainstream. And of course, with any technology, you want to look for the reaction to technology, the frustration tolerance, motivation, perseverance, and fatigue. Do they wear out? Do they like the stuff? How dogged are they in terms of learning things? And then trust but verify on computer knowledge. When you're working with folks, many people will tell you that they really know the computer well. But then, you know, when you look under a hood, what happens is that they're experts at something like solitaire or mine, what is that, Minesweeper or something like that. And they don't really know hard drive management or, you know, how to find a document, et cetera, like that. Has that ever happened to anybody in the audience today? Let's take a vote on that, where people say that they really know computers, but then they know, you know, Facebook or something. A lot of you, yeah. Here's the poll. Yeah, so a fair amount. So, okay, thanks. Yeah, there you go. Pros of Facebook, but cannot find simple documents. I am officially on Facebook, but that's mainly just to spy on my kids. I have 5 children. So, anyway, okay, next slide. Timing and accuracy can be measured, but you can't fully go by that. You want to have some AT for parents. Time and accuracy can be measured, but validity can be questionable due to learning curves. If you try something new with somebody, they may not get the hang of it. So you can't just say, geez, a standard keyboard is faster than another keyboard because of they don't know it as well. But, you know, you can get a general sense if people are way off the mark. And I also found, you know, a lot of times, if you're working particularly sometimes with somebody with cerebral palsy, that might have a lot of spasticity. If you're nervous or kind of anxious about them, then they have this kind of performance pressure, and then their results can drop. So, you know, I mean, it's easy to relax and have a good time. I mean, I love my job. I've been doing it for 19 years. But that, I think that's part of it. If you seem kind of hyped up, well, then you're not going to get the numbers that you may need. Okay, next slide. Everything starts with seating. When we're looking at computer access, people think about the keyboard and the mouse, but you really want to start with seating. Of course, the general rule of thumb is feet flat on the floor with the weight evenly divided between the thighs and feet. And then when I do an assessment, I always pull people. Now, if they come into my lab, we have about 30 different high-end ergonomic chairs of my choosing. But even if I go out to the work site and they're using that specific chair, I will pull them away from the work site to size them up for the seating. Because what happens is that people will adjust their body to the workstation, even if it's a lousy workstation. So you want to work from the person out versus kind of locking in what they have currently. Essentially, let's wipe the slate clean and then see what we have versus trying to index off of that existing workstation. Next slide. Of course, you want to couple 2 or 3 fingers behind the knees. If someone's short-statured, if you have somebody who's 5'2", they're typically going to slump in their chair because they can't hit the floor. And poor seating just makes it all the operations, even from this good diaphragmatic breathing to good posture, hard to do. Armrests as applicable, and knowing the general understanding of wheelchair seating, not that you have to be a wheelchair expert, but if you see somebody that's very poorly fitted in the wheelchair, slumped over, or just in a bad setup, it's going to be hard to access the computer. Many times you're working with somebody, boy, if they had the thoracic support just where they need it, then they could have a lot better control of the keyboard and mouse or whatever. Okay. Next slide. Generally, I like armrests because it helps get out of the chair, so it helps your back. You can get stability, support, and reduce the load on your back because your arms weigh something, so then they can rest. The armrests move with the chair and don't get in the way as much as the table mount support. But sometimes, and you can also get upgraded ones that allow you to change, you know, most of them you can change the height now, but a lot of them you can change the width, the angle, and the pitch of all these things for ergonomic chairs. And I can never predict, like I said, we have a couple dozen of these very high-end chairs, all the big names, all the high-end chairs, and I can never predict what chair someone will like. Everybody's back is different. So even though I've been doing this a long time, people say, well, what chair should you get? And it's like, I don't know, because people, I'll have one chair. So let's say somebody's sitting in a Herman Miller Aeron chair, for example. Well, you know, one person might say, oh, geez, I can't stand that chair. And then the next person might, you know, say, you're not taking this from me. This is the only thing that's going to work for me. So you can never predict. It's just because everybody's back pain is different. Any questions so far? I've just been rambling on, and I don't get any feedback when we're doing these webinars. But feel free to pop those up on the screen if you have any. Arm supports. I'm a huge fan of arm supports. You can get it more specialized, offloading better with the than just traditional arm supports that are on a chair. I'm a big fan of static or the fixed forearm supports. That they can be useful for those with spasticity control issues or shoulder pain. Of course, there's articulating forearm supports that move around on little ball bearings. Has anybody ever used any of those for any consumers that they work with? Let's take a vote on that. So let's do the poll. Of course, I have. Maybe I'm an outlier here. Oh, fair amount. Drum roll, please. Here's the big election results. So, yeah, some have used it. And I can tell you, I've had many people use those gray ones you see on the slide. That's called the Morency Rest, which is found in gel wrist supports. There you go. Morency Rest. MorencyRest.com. I just typed that in there. And again, I don't get a cut from any of this type of stuff, but I like those a lot. You clamp them onto the front side of the workstation. So one caveat on that is that they do not work on those pull-out slide desktops because they're too flimsy, and people are actually, and you're clamping this thing on there. Okay, next slide. So for the workstations, we generally want to start at the elbow height. And now if people have a significant difficulty, that quickly breaks down. But generally, I get people to kind of bounce their shoulders up and down and just kind of get them at a relaxed position and then find that place of the elbow at the elbow once their feet are flat on the floor. And this is assuming that they're going to be their primary task is going to be keyboarding. If you're going to be writing, that's a more finer control, closer finger dexterity with handwriting, so then you want to put probably a little bit higher. But generally for computer access is what we're concerned about mainly. We're looking at around elbow height. I don't get overly hung up about it if it's kind of plus or minus an inch or two, or an inch, probably not two. But the main thing, you don't want people sitting there with this kind of praying mantis big wristband to the flexion or extension side. There's a ton of computer access technologies for keyboards, and I'd like to go over those, modification alternatives, mouse modifications. Some of the, next slide, some of the keyboard modifications, key guards, this is the plastic guards that go over top of the keys to help people finger their funnel their fingers down to a key. Plus, they can also, if you have folks that need to kind of lean on a key, like if they're trying to hit a key and they wind up whacking a bunch of keys on either side of it, then you can use that as a blocker, the key guard. There's moisture guards. There's tactile cues. Of course, everybody has tactile cues on their keyboard now, and those are those little nubs on the F and J key. But we find them very helpful for folks that are, for example, using a standard keyboard with one-handed use. And then the keys that require a big stretch, we can put a little bump dot on there to help them lock in on where the, you know, the big stretch of the letter Q or P or something like that could be. And you can also get oversized letters or color-coded keys, perhaps maybe for somebody with a cognitive disability. Next slide. And there's software modifications, the ones that are built into Windows, sticky keys, filter keys, toggle keys. Of course, those are under Windows 7. Those are found under the Ease of Access Center. But one way to get to that is hitting the Shift key 5 times in a row. And that will pop up sticky keys, filter keys, toggle keys. The sticky keys allow keys that normally need to be fired up sequentially to be fired up at the same time. And the filter keys are, for example, can be used for somebody who is slow to lift up on the keys. So if I, for example, if I type my letter P for Paul and I pull it up very slowly, I will have 13 letter P's up on the screen. So then that will allow me to just fire one off at a time. A Dvorak keyboard layout, you can see that on the slide there, where it's designed, optimized. They have a right-handed keyboard, a left-handed keyboard, and a central keyboard where they're optimized letter pattern, because the standard QWERTY keyboard is not optimized for keyboard action. Actually, the story on that is it was reverse ergonomics. The QWERTY keyboard was designed with a manual typewriter. Okay, now this is an age test, because I'm going to say how many actually learned to type a key on a keyboard using a manual typewriter. Okay, so let's take a vote here. Okay, well, and here we go. There we go. 21 said yes. And, yeah, what's a typewriter? Okay. Jamie Wiseacre. Yes. And the door prize for today is an IBM Selectric, which is cutting edge. But anyway. The QWERTY keyboard was set up because the original typewriters were like a black box. Because if you learn to write to type on a typewriter, the fingers, if you type too fast, the keys would get jammed. Remember that? And so then you'd go up and flick the keys down, the strikers, to unjam it. Well, the original keyboards were like in a box, so then you had to take it apart. So then the story goes, hard to verify one way or the other, is that they tried to set it up that the keys would slow you up, so that way you'd be less likely to jam the keys, which is a darn shame, because now, of course, that technology is neither here nor there, and we're stuck with this darn QWERTY layout. But the Dvorak, they made an attempt to come up with a more efficient layout. However, the de facto standard is a QWERTY, so we have it. Okay. Letter-by-letter feedback. This can be helpful for folks where every time they strike a key, they can hear the feedback of the letter, and then that way they don't have to look up at the screen. If they have a disability that requires them to look down on the letters, then they know that they actually typed the letter T, for example. Next slide. So the keyboard trials, can an individual use a standard keyboard, and if so, can they use both hands? What fingers? Do they need elbow forearm wrist support? Is the key in height correct? You know, with their arms comfortably at the side. When we're doing next slide, when we're doing a keyboard trial, is the angle correct for the keyboard? Many times, I'm a big fan of a negative tilt keyboard where the little kickstand is actually below the space bar. Sometimes you get a lot of keyboards that have the little kickstand wing things, technical term, underneath like the function keys. And of course, what that can do for some folks is create additional wrist extension. But a negative tilt keyboard can help people line it up a little bit better. So sometimes I look for that. Is it in the correct position? Are they lined up center? Can they use a standard keyboard with a mouse stick, a stylus, a head pointer, or with their toes? I've set that up with folks. Notice how I'm starting from the simple things, working my way up. Standard keyboard modification, do they need an alternative keyboard? This is just all with the basic keyboard starting out. Sometimes what you'll see, well, at least what I see in my practice, is folks come in with ideas of some high-end thing because they saw it on, you know, Popular Science, or their brother-in-law saw it on the show or something like that. But we always want to start with the simple stuff and work our way up because these things can break down. They cost more. They need more training. So if I can get it by, I mean, not that I'm going to compromise anybody's efficiency, but if it can work with a simpler one, we want to make that happen. Least restrictive environment. There we go. Next slide. So there's a number of alternative keyboards, from the ergonomic ones, oversized, space-saving, one-handed, and other ones. On-screen, scanning, speech recognition, and some specialty items. This tongue-touch keypad, I am working with somebody who's using one of those. And, of course, there's Braille for Braille users. Ergonomic keyboards, typically used for those with repetitive stress injuries or cumulative trauma, carpal tunnel, etc. The whole idea behind it is that we try to keep our body in as much neutral posture as we can, and the little wedge shape in the center of one of those wave-style keyboards minimizes our wrist deviation out to the pinky side or ulnar side. If there's any occupational therapists or PTs in the room. And it has a little hump in the middle to keep the internal rotation of our wrist down. There's a lot of them out there. Anybody use those personally on your computer? Well, kind of your Wave computer? Let's do a vote on that. So, a couple folks. Yeah, not everybody likes them. Let's see the vote here. Yeah, so 13 people in the room. I would have guessed lower than that. So there's a lot of them out there. This is a Microsoft style here, one of them out there. But because they're listed ergonomic, it doesn't actually mean they're ergonomic. The Human Factors and Ergonomic Society doesn't have a trademark on the term ergonomic. So anything in last year's catalog that wasn't ergonomic could be easily changed to ergonomic by the advertising gurus. So you have to go with what really works with the person and not get overly in love with the word ergonomic in front of a product name, because it's counterproductive for somebody who's using a stick or a stylus, a mouse stick, or a one-fingered user. But they do, the learning curve is pretty quick on those, because the cord layout's the same. Next slide. A number of oversized keyboards out there, typically used with those with gross motor skills, but limited fine motor. And you need to figure out what the range of motion is when you're using an oversized keyboard. Speed and accuracy with different sizes. Of course, we're running against this conundrum of, if you get it too big so they can hit the keys, well then of course you limit the amount of keys the range of motion. So you're trying to find this line of how big a key can be if you're using like IntelliKeys or without going outside of their range of motion. Sometimes they can be customized or converted to big switches. Next slide. Oh, there we go. Question. We have many employees using BlackBerry devices nonstop. What do you suggest for ergonomic keyboarding for BlackBerry mobile devices? That's a great question. I mean, I've looked at those. Essentially, BlackBerry uses thumb keys where they're hitting those all the time. And, of course, so are my teenagers, by the way. They've been known to text a few times. But, I mean, other than going out to, you know, there are some aftermarket products that are allow you to use a standard keyboard with some sort of mobile device. But I don't see a lot of folks using those because, you know, they're going to whip them out wherever they are and start cracking those things open. I mean, I think one of the thing I see is probably speech recognition. Voice recognition apps. Absolutely. I have speech recognition on my iTouch, and that works really well. It's very clever how that does that. You don't actually have the speech engine on the iTouch or iPhone. It goes and it's cloud computing. You're going back to Massachusetts to get your voice analyzed, and it pops back up. Now there's Jot. Now, is that a speech recognition one? I'm not familiar with that one. Leo, tell me what that is. Okay. I'm not familiar with that one. Oh, 800 number. Okay, so then that does that, so you're dialing in. What is Jot? There we go. So we'll learn about that one. Let's go to the next slide. So space-saving mini keyboards. Typically used with fine motor skills but limited range of motion. It can be used for mouse or mouse placement. Because with the smaller one, a smaller keyboard, then of course we can line up our mouse better than with a wider keyboard. And if for mouse stick users, it reduces the sweep area so they don't have to move their neck from left to right as frequently. Okay, next slide. Sorry about that. So some of the other keyboards out there, dish keyboards, if you see this Maltron dish keyboard, and that allows the arc of the keyboard to match up with the arc of a sweep of a mouse stick. I've set that up for one person, and she loved it. Left-handed keyboard, if you notice this keyboard, it has the number pad on the left side. And the reason that's helpful is because if you have somebody who does not use a number pad a whole lot, it allows the mouse to be brought in closer in line with the body than this kind of external shoulder rotation that's required when you're setting the mouse up typically. And I guess in my work I find that a lot of folks have more issues with mouse use than they do with the actual keyboarding. So we focus a lot on that. And Jamie talks about the mini keyboards work great for smaller hands and with a built-in trackball as well. Absolutely. Next slide. One-handed keyboards. We have a number of these out there. This shows the Bat keyboard and a product that shows a concept of, they've changed the model of it, but I like this picture. It's a half QWERTY keyboard. A number of folks that need one-handed typing, sometimes they will just go with speech recognition. Other times that's not appropriate, so then they'll look at some sort of alternative method. Now, a lot of times the best method is learning how to type with one hand. And that's where those bump dots can help. So when people have to stretch their pinky and their thumb out to, or index finger out to a far way, they're going to know what they're going to hit. But there are a number of options out there for one-handed use. Next slide. On-screen keyboards, when you have extremely limited range of motion, but people can run a mouse, they can also often come with rate enhancement features. And because they do take up the screen, we want to get a nice large monitor to be able to use one of those. Next slide. Here's an example of an on-screen keyboard. This is the Reach Interface Author. I'll get to that in a minute. Visual scanning up and down, addressing Leo's. Visual scanning up and down to the keyboard is difficult. Absolutely, when you're bouncing back and forth between the keyboard and the monitor. I call it the chicken dance. Is that what you're referring to, Leo? Keep people focused on the screen without having to look down at the keyboard, that's the way to go. An on-screen keyboard, this one has a nice feature, this Reach Interface Author. If you notice that, let's say I wanted to type the word little, and on the first screen, with my pointer, I would click the letter L. Well, then all the words that do not begin with the letter L pop up, disappear from the screen. And, of course, that helps my visual tracking of the on-screen keyboard. And, of course, if you were going to spell a word like llama that is kind of unique, then you could always hit the escape key and it would pop up. So a nice little feature. But there is an on-screen keyboard built into Windows. Jamie asked about the Frog Pad, which is one-handed keyboard. Now, that was out of production. They're still hoping to make some. Unless anybody's heard anything else, their website says they're down right now, and I think it's one of these manufacturing deals where they have to get enough orders to make a job lot to make more. I got a call from a consumer a couple weeks ago. Hers broke, and she couldn't get a new one. So next slide. Scanning keyboard. They're very similar to the on-screen keyboard, usually used for single or dual switch users. It's slow, but you can do it. And that's what, if people have progressive disability, such as ALS, I always like the ladies out there because and sometimes in their head they're projecting, geez, what am I going to do if I can't do this thing? Well, if somebody has any voluntary movement in their whole body, well, then they are able to activate a keyboard, and they say, and you can email your buds. Next slide. Speech recognition is suggested by everyone, it seems like. But I'm always a naysayer. I've set up many, many people throughout the years of speech recognition. It's gotten much better. It's gotten much better for the recognition rate. For example, Dragon's up to version 11, and I would say the last couple of versions, they haven't dumped a whole lot of new features on it, but what they've done is they've worked on the accuracy. And actually, one of the ways they've gotten accuracy is with the iTouch version. I talked about the Dragon on the iTouch. All that data that's going back into headquarters in Massachusetts, I believe, is they're using it to analyze people's voices and what they say to improve the accuracy for the next every year's model. But I do like that. I like to undersell and over-deliver on speech recognition because many people still think it's going to be like some sort of Star Trek movie. And it's not. I mean, you have to work at it to make it better. Windows has a nice model. Their program works well. If you have a good quality microphone, that's all you need for that one. It doesn't have the same command and control, but you can use it. John Lee asked me, what are my thoughts on Windows 7 versus Dragon? Well, if you're going to have, if you need any command and control, you're going to want to use Dragon. I have recommended Speech 7, Windows Speech Recognition, for a couple folks that have more mildly cases of some sort of upper extremity injury, carpal tunnel tendonitis, where they can use it, but they don't need to use it all the time. The one downside on the speech, on the Windows version, is that there isn't a lot of data out there. You're kind of left flying because there's just not a lot of training materials, and when you fire up Windows, they don't give you a whole lot with it. But the speech engine itself is actually pretty nice. So if you have Windows, it's worth ditching around and see. You just need a good microphone. I'm a big fan of the VXI Talk Pro USB. I get that a lot. I'm actually wearing it right now to do this webinar. For speech recognition. I typically upgrade everybody when I get Dragon to a better microphone than the one that comes in the box. Was that helpful, John? And James uses Dragon. James Jablonski. Okay, next slide. Yeah, so just have we have, many of us have worked with Dragon. Anybody use, let's take a vote on this. Does anybody use Dragon on a regular basis as to actually write the reports and do whatever? Couple. Yeah, wow. Five do. It's interesting. I mean, for all the Dragon training I do to professionals and to consumers, I don't actually use it on a day-to-day basis. That's one of the things I probably should, but I don't. And it's gotten better. Many of you are in the same boat, it looks like. Okay, next slide. Speech recognition. I talked about that. Okay, now John's talking about, no, it doesn't handle very low voices well. Okay. Oh, now John, are you referring to Windows 7 or the microphone that doesn't handle very low voices very well? Very low voices well. If you can respond, that'd be great. Oh, no, Dragon doesn't handle my voice. Okay. With a real deep, so you have a very deep voice? Okay, so what you do need is good comprehension skills, reading skills. You need to be able to read to pick these things off. Of course, there's no such thing as a misspelled word, but there are misrecognized words. So sometimes you'll say hello and it thinks you said jello. So you'll still need decoding skills of what's up on the screen, and need some motivation. And the training has gone down, but you still need to work at it to make it happen. And I'm a big believer in backups and mice. No matter who I work with, if most people, regardless, even if they have a high-level spinal cord injury, don't want to use Dragon to operate a mouse. It can be kind of tedious. Next slide. There's some specialty items. Morse code. Morse code is actually for single switch users a lot faster than anybody using an on-screen keyboard. So if they have good control and can fire off a switch with consistency, that can be a very fast way to operate a computer if you're a single switch user. A tongue touch keypad. This is something that looks like a when you get your braces off, you get those things what do you call those? I'm blanking out on it. Retainer. Yeah, you retain John Lee, man, you are on it. the retainer. So it's like a retainer and it rip your mouth, but it has 9 switches that you fire with your tongue. And I'm working with somebody now that uses one that works pretty slick. Wheelchair, very small company, so support isn't great. Very small outfit. But it works great for this consumer. Of course, there's Braille Note for people using a Brailler, kind of the electronic version of the Perkins Brailler. Next slide. We also look at switch considerations when we're doing switches. We're concerned about positioning, where it's going to go, what type of motion to activate it, how big the target should be, and what are the force requirements to make that thing work. What are we concerned about? Next slide. Accuracy and timing, the repeatability. Can you do it over time? Durability. Will the thing bust up? Does that switch activation burn the person out? Do they get tired out? And importantly, the ease of setup for the support team. This is a big issue because many folks, most of the folks that need an alternative switch to operate their computer might need somebody to set it up. And if it takes a team just, 20 minutes to set it up and line everything up, then I feel like a lot of times once you go away, that person won't get set up too often. So if you can make it very simple for the support staff around the consumer, then that can help enhance their odds of getting it set up once you leave. Next slide. And we're looking at mice now. So with the standard mice, is it at the proper height and position? Of course, I talked about having the mouse over on the external rotation, trying to prevent external rotation if we can, sometimes by getting that left-handed keyboard that has the number pad on the left side. Do they need any wrist support or arm support? Can they click drag with accuracy? And does their body allow it to work in the same space? Otherwise, we can get, the other way I've done it is I've gotten a Kinesis keyboard, Kinesis Maxim, or Kinesis Freestyle. Let's see, Kinesis Freestyle or Maxim. That's an ergonomic keyboard with the wedge shape and the hump in the middle, but it has you have to get a separate number pad. And what that allows you to do is to bring the mouse in closer to the midline of your body. Of course, the other thing you do is do what I did, and I have converted myself to left-handed mousing. So I mouse with my left, so that way I can get it more in line. Okay, next slide. And you get used to it. Number of mouse modifications. You can adjust the speed and acceleration or the button arrangements. Or sometimes folks, they can use a mouse, but they have a hard time hitting that mouse button. So then you can get an alternative switch in lieu of clicking the buttons. Next slide. Alternative mice, there's a number of them out there. I'm a big fan of this one called the vertical mouse. This is the vertical mouse. I'm just typing these things out. Is this helpful for you guys? Just so you can see what I'm writing. Vertical mouse by Evolutant. So that's the picture of the one on the top. I like that one because that allows that thumbs up position, which is kind of the neutral posture for your body. And then the trackballs, there's a number of them out there. The Kensington Expert Mouse I've used for years. I like that one because it has a nice big ball and a nice big buttons. I love a picture of that. The joystick, I had a picture of that earlier. That's a Penny and Giles joystick. So those are helpful for some folks. Some people, if you have a wheelchair driver, then they know how to run a joystick well, and that can work for them. And the other thing in the picture there is called a roller mouse, too. That's a little slide bar that sits right below the keypad. I've had some folks that really like that. John Lee likes the roller mouse. Good. Foot mouse, that's kind of neat. That's the two gas pedal things that go on your feet. But most people, you have to like make a muscle in your leg to keep that up unless it's perfectly balanced. So you can have a fair amount of static load in your legs to make it uncomfortable for you. Next slide. So mouse keys, that's where you can use the Windows system to convert your number pad into a mouse, or you can use a trackpad, which many are familiar with using a laptop. Very little range of motion is required, and you can set that up with an external trackpad. Touchscreens are great many times for folks with cognitive disabilities because there's a direct relationship with the cursor, so they can go up and point to what they want to go. And keyboard shortcuts, I'm a huge fan of keyboard shortcuts. In the post-IBM Selectric days and the new computer days, everybody had no keyboard shortcuts. But then the graphic interface style of Apple really changed that, where everybody has, you want to hit a picture, you want to print something out, you go up and click the icon of the printer, which is great for training because the training time is reduced because you don't have to memorize everything, but you have to just look up and see the picture of the icon. The downside is that you wind up using a mouse a lot more, and we find that we have a lot more trouble with people using the mouse. So people can memorize some of the hot keyboard shortcuts that can help minimize a lot of discomfort. So there's my plug on keyboard shortcuts. Big fan. Next slide. Some folks use things like the head mouse, which uses a reflective dot on your glasses or the forehead, and then you can move around. You need good neck control, but then you can run around, move the mouse with that. A mouse joystick, the Joust is pictured here. That's an example of one where it's a little joystick that you can move around with your mouse, and then the click, you can sip and puff into the mouse. There's also other alternatives, such as a scanning mic software or a Morse code. There's actually Morse code developed to run the mouse using Morse code. Has anybody ever worked with anybody that has used Morse code? Let's take a vote on that. Let's see. Just a couple. Only in ham radio. There you go. Y'all believe me. My dad was a ham radio operator, and I remember he listened to those LPs of practicing dots and dashes as a kid. Maybe that's not why I never went into it. Okay, next slide. So there's a number of rate enhancers for... I have a friend who can read more as fast than he can speak. I believe it. Abbreviation expansion, which when you're typing, you can speed it up by having, and of course, abbreviation expansion by having this style. And of course, people use that in effect when they're doing texting, when they do those shortcuts. Word completion, where when you're typing along, you see options. If you type the letter C, then all the words will start with C. And what they found that it's not a whole lot faster for folks, because then you have to go up and look at the screen and verify, okay, where is it on the list? So then they're bouncing back and forth. So I think kind of the general rule of thumb is, geez, if you're less than 3 words a minute, sometimes some sort of savings can be had with word completion. But it could be used for fatigue or learning disability versus just a physical access. There you go. And Jamie says, I use word prediction for folks with TBI, stroke, or single-handed use. There you go. Thanks, Jamie. And, of course, there's macro software where something like Macro Express, where you can have a whole string of text fired up by just hitting a couple of little keystrokes. And that Macro Express, there's a free trial on that you can download to try that out. And that, of course, that tends to work better in a business setting when people have typing the same thing over and over again. They have certain phrases, et cetera, that can work in a business. If they're doing school, it kind of varies a lot more than a business setting, and that's harder. There's also a macro keyboard. I'm a big fan of these. I've used these where you have a little dedicated, the smallest one is about the size of a separate number pad, where you can have dedicated keys to equal a whole string of keys on the keyboard. For example, I used one of the times I used that for somebody who was doing customer service or taking orders on the phone, actually at one of those big water parks in the Wisconsin Dells. And many of the folks that would call up were from the same zip codes time and time again all around actually Chicagoland. So we just set up a macro keyboard that he could, when he heard them, he could just fire the button up for those keystrokes, for those zip codes to save some keystrokes. Anybody ever use X keys with anybody? Let's take a vote on that. So they're about $100, and that can work well in settings where people have to type the same things over and over and over again. And then they don't have to memorize the keystrokes because it's just a button that you just label yourself. Let's look at that. So three people have used it. Okay. Okay, boy, time's flying. Output monitors, when we're looking at, of course, we talked about that person-machine interface. We're getting back to the actually seeing the screen. And if we're looking at the monitor, the general rule of thumb is that we want to try to get the top line of the monitor at or slightly below eye level. And so with the monitors, with a lot of them now have the adjustable height monitor stand, and I always look for that when I'm getting a monitor for somebody, because that allows me to set it up right where I want to. Generally, if anything, most people have it too high rather than too low. So, you know, it used to be, oh, geez, put some telephone books underneath it. Well, in general, I think most of them are too high. And you have to factor in if they're using bifocal or trifocal vision, what part of the lens are they actually looking at that monitor? Because then we want to line that up so we can capture that part of the lens. Oversized monitors are great because then you can create, you know, make larger text. And they've come down dramatically in price. And glare schemes, very rarely do we look at those anymore. Just because the flat panels, many times they have a matted surface on them. The next slide. Output options, text enlargement feature, such as a product like Zoom Text, where you can make the whole screen look larger. Of course, there's one built into Windows. Zoom Text allows a number of other features versus the basic one that comes with Windows. Screen readers such as JAWS or Window Eyes. Do we have any JAWS users out there right now? In the class? We're doing a vote. Okay, cool. How many JAWS users? Thanks for, this is great. I'm getting into this voting thing. Maybe it's too much. But okay, so something like JAWS users, Apple VoiceOver, nice. Okay. And there's a number of other players out there for that. And there's also a text highlighter with reading. This is such as Kurzweil 3000 or Text Help, or Premier Literacy has a product. NVDA is a screen reader. Okay, that's a free one. All right. So for folks with learning disabilities, having the text highlighted and read out loud is found to be very helpful. Magnifier Magic. There you go. There's another great selection. I love that. Hey, you guys are active. I appreciate that a lot. Next slide. So some of the case studies I've done in the past, I have pictures to show you just to illustrate some concepts. This person I set up with speech recognition, and I used a voice tracker microphone, and that's the used dragon. This person has a high-level spinal cord injury, but notice how I also gave set up a mouse stick with a little mouse stick holder and a mini keyboard and a trackball, and that allowed him to activate this even when the dragon wasn't working and to operate the voice now. This one, I'd probably change this a little bit now with current setup just because there's a dragon has a Bluetooth option. There's a lot of nice wireless microphones because even though this is a good microphone for one that's mounted on the desktop, I think it's tough to beat the ones that are right at your mouth. So getting the Bluetooth version or some sort of wireless mic we could improve his accuracy. Any questions on this case here? Okay, let's go to the next slide here. Okay, can you describe the stand the keyboard and mouse are on? This one, we made this one. That's the advantage. We have a full shop. So we have a little mounted wood. So then I found the pitch that worked best for the little mini keyboard. And then so we built a stand that held the trackball. And then the trackball just knifed just below the keyboard at an angle. The microphone just above that. How did he drive? He used a head array. So he had a head array system where he could operate his wheelchair. Good question. That was Leo. Next slide. This is speech recognition here. This person, he could have used array at the mouse. That's true. Not at that time. He could now. That wasn't available. But you know what? That's a good. Leo brings up a great point. We got a couple minutes left. But another mouse alternative now is with the newer wheelchairs of toggling into a mouse mode. Some of the systems work better than others. I set one up as a demo with somebody earlier this year, and they still preferred using the joust versus toggling into the wheelchair mode. But I'm glad you brought it up. Thanks. This is somebody who uses a wheelchair as well. But we also have them set up, this is a joust, this is a mouth-operated joystick, but then we just mounted the microphone for speech recognition, Dragon, on the base of this joystick, mouth joystick, so that she could talk on her voice, and then she was also able to run the mouse with this joystick. She also wanted a traditional page turner, so we set up the Zygo page turner, and that's what that little Tash microlight switch is on her left forehead. Next slide. The question is, did the state or voc rehab or school district fund all the equipment? Yes, they did on these. Otherwise, I wouldn't have a slide to show you. sometimes, they're private pay, but that's pretty rare in my practice. Thank you, Debbie. This is a program analyst for the state of Wisconsin. He's using a large screen keyboard with a word completion on there. And then on the top of the large screen keyboard, You see those white keys that are on that keyboard? That is an X keys key stick, and that has macro keys. That allows us to him to have specialty keys. So he had one like email my boss, and when he'd hit those keys, he could just fire that up and it would turn on his email, and then, you know, have a pre-canned startup of an email to his supervisor. And then we just got a pad for his arm. He's an L-shaped workstation, and he was ready to roll. We got next slide. So you want to know the product categories, not just the products. Try them all out. Don't fall in love with this. Does it just look cool or functional? An example of that is the virtually indestructible keyboard, which is one of these little membrane keyboards that you can roll up. Everybody's kind of drawn to that in the lab, but it's not real functional for most people. Actually, I've never set up with anybody. Ergonomic chair, you want to have something that has some nice adjustment in your lab, if you can do that, or in your office. Next slide. Get some specific products based on the consumer population you work with. Start simple and work your way up. Don't run out and buy some highfalutin, you know, eye gaze system that you're going to use twice a year. You know, start off with a couple ergonomic keyboards, a couple ergonomic mice. And then if you're only going to use things a couple times, it wasn't indestructible, let's give it to you. Can you just get a loaner, or can you discreetly buy the thing at Best Buy and save the receipt and return it if you need to try it out? Less finding requires more creativity and assessment, like I'm telling you anything. Okay, next slide. So some of the places you can get resources, the Great Lakes ADA Center or your ADA Center in your region, wherever you may be. The job accommodation, JAN, of course, local professionals that do assistive technology. Alamed, I like the Alamed catalog, alamed.com. Any other ones you can throw out there, if you have some favorites, you can put them up on the screen. Resna, or do you have a good assessment template to share with adult private business use? We have ergonomists, but not always versed in other types of assistive technology. You know what? I don't, Debbie. That's a good question. Like a canned template. This is the closest you're going to get. Just because when you're working with more severe disabilities, things to break down pretty quickly in terms of a model of doing an assessment. I mean, I have a standard methodology, but I don't have a canned template. I'm sorry. But yeah, we do run into that. I'm a certified ergonomist, but the other side of the equation is all the AT stuff of knowing all those doodads. Looking for somebody, you could also go to the resna.org website, and there you go, Accessing Higher Ground Conference, great for the university level. There you go. That's in Colorado, isn't it? So resna.org. You can check for somebody who's a certified assistive technology practitioner. The state AT projects, excellent idea. Tech Act, WISTECH, of course, we actually run WISTECH. Professional organizations, listservs. I'm a huge fan of the resident listserv. Of course, I'm a member of the board, but it's free to anybody. And if you have questions about AT, you can fire them away on the, and you can go to that website that I listed, resident.org. Geez, I have a minute left for questions, and I started talking very fast. Any other questions? I think it's been great working with you. I appreciate all the feedback electronically. Hopefully you got some information out about this from this. My contact information is listed there, so if you think of anything else.
I think, Paul, this is Janet, and yes. Thank you, everyone, for your great participation today. Thanks, Paul, for a really great session. As Paul said, we are out of time, and if you didn't have your question asked, you can certainly call us, and our 1-800 number is 1-800-949-4232, and that number will also get you to the ADA Center in your region. Paul is a great speaker, and I hope you got something out of it. We would ask that you evaluate the session. The session link is here. I'll also be sending an email today to give us some feedback on the session. And with that, you'll be receiving a link of the archived session, and I'd like to thank you for your participation. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks a lot.